What's up, everyone? It's me again with a brand new episode of the Heart Speaks Pod. And in this episode, I speak with Stephanie Lepp from the Center for Humane Technology. We talk about one of my favorite topics ever, Disney. The great creator and translator of fairy tales for kids and adults alike, Disney is responsible for transmitting values and value systems to millions of people around the world. And whether it knows it or not, this responsibility is deeply sacred and requires an attitude and orientation in service of that sacredness. So many themes come up in this episode: childhood development, the masculine and the feminine, the culture wars, and Disney's place in it. And of course, as always, the Jungian element behind so many of the films we know and love. This was a really fun EP to record, so be sure to check it out and share with your friends.
All right, well, hi, Chloe.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I don't even know how to answer that question anymore. Everything. How? That's really Everything. The operative question. How in the world do I happen to still be doing despite how are we doing? We just, I don't know, we just keep on doing, don't we?
Yeah. Keep on keeping on. Yeah.
How are you doing?
Stephanie, I'm doing well. Chilling in Cancer season, you know? And I'm doing well. I think I've gotten into a pretty good routine so far in terms of like being balanced and bringing balance to my life. I have my morning meditation, reading about the chakra system, avoiding excessive social media. Nice. So just like, you know, living in that
balance. Sounds really lovely. That sounds like something that I can maybe have in 10 years when my kids are old enough. Yeah, my mornings are, I show up to like a staff meeting and everyone's like been meditating and drinking tea for 2 hours. And I've like been in a battle. I want to like zoom the floor. It's like, do you want to look at the battlefield of the evidence of all the, commotion that went up? But well, good. You enjoy it. And I will vicariously just like enjoy the calmness lathering over me. Well, so yeah, so the premise of our conversation today is Disney's hero's journey. And the way that I would kind of frame it up would be something like, humans co-evolve with the stories that we tell about ourselves, right? Fictional and non-fictional, right? The stories that we tell ourselves become part of how we understand ourselves, the world, how we act in the world. And Disney is a, let's say, a vital organ of storytelling in American culture. You know, Disney stories in ways that you know much better than I do, Disney stories have influence over how we and critically how our young people understand ourselves and understand the world. And so we could say that we co-evolve with Disney stories, right? Like these stories really matter. Meanwhile, you know, Disney is a Fortune 500 company, Fortune 500 public company that is prey to the same, you know, rivalrous dynamics that its stories are kind of increasingly trying to help us transcend, you could even say. But it's like it's prey to these exact dynamics. And so we could then say Disney has kind of a unique opportunity to kind of help us transcend these dynamics by going on its own hero's journey, right? And I would think about that in two ways. One is its own hero's journey in terms of the stories that it tells. And that's one thing that I would love for us to explore is how Disney stories have themselves evolved over time and how they might keep evolving. And then it might go on its own hero's journey also in terms of the way that it as a company navigates situations where it gets caught in these rivalrous dynamics, right? Yeah. So maybe that can just kind of be an opening frame for us.
I love that. When I think of Disney, I certainly think of fairy tales. You know, they're famous for basically repurposing fairy tales. I mean, that's how they became what they are today. And now, after repurposing fairy tales, they tell their own fairy tales as well. They've created their own fairy tales as well, completely new. And the purpose of fairy tales, primarily, I think, is to transmit sort of values to young people. And there is a challenge, I think, with Disney in the sense that its audience has actually ballooned and grown past simply just being young people, right? It's like everyone, basically, is in their target market. And that's very tricky because I think you're supposed to be able to, I mean, you can only absorb certain values and certain lessons, it actually changes what values you can absorb depending upon your age. And so we've seen over time, for example, Disney's villains become more complicated. So if you think of like Sleeping Beauty villain, very simple. The villain is bad, right? And then you think of like Maleficent. And so you have this like complexity. The challenge with that is young people actually require very black and white caricatures.
And we,
in order to make sense of the world.
And it takes black and white to make gray.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so you can't actually jump to the nuance by skipping over the black and white caricature first. I mean, this is sort of such a paradox because my organization teaches nuance and things like that. But there are, like I said, there are different developmental stages at which you can access nuance and which you just simply cannot. And which nuance actually can become a detriment if you learn it at too young an age. So there's an interesting thing. There's an interesting challenge. I'd be curious to hear what you think
about that. Yeah, no, and I've experienced this with my daughter. I mean, the wild thing about being alive now and watching Disney with my kids now is that I have all of the above, right? I have the whole evolution. I have the early Disney movies, and she's seen those where, and the way that we dealt with the bad guy was we banished the bad guy. Right? Ursula, Jafar, Scar, they either died or we banished them. Or, and then we get to Moana, right? And now the bad guy is the good guy without her heart, right? Or we get to Frozen and Encanto, and there isn't even necessarily so much of a, it's like people who had fear or who didn't totally understand. And she still talks about bad guys. And I'm not going to tell her like, oh, but wait, remember there is no such thing as a bad guy. It's like, no, she can totally believe in bad guys. Because again, it's like, we don't want to just, right? It's not that it's all gray. I'd rather have more ingredients. Now I get to have white, black, and gray, right? And there gets to be different circumstances under which, or I have all three concepts now to use and to play with. I also don't, I guess it's, there's two things that I don't want to lose. I don't want to lose black and white because that can be really helpful. And there's some things for her that's like, no, you don't cross the street without looking both. There are some things that are just black and white and I need her to know to understand. And then, you know, we can get into gray. But the other thing I don't want to take away from her is I also don't want to take away her opportunity to evolve. It's like, what, who am I to like give her all these realizations I've enjoyed having on my own and that have been so beneficial for me to have? I mean, not entirely on my own, but I'm not going to take away her experience of revelation.
Right. That would be really stifling to take away her capacity to come into revelation on her own. I'm curious, when she watches Frozen, is the kind of, or Encanto, because I think Frozen does have that one bad guy, but especially Encanto, is the concept of nuance, does it go completely over her head, basically?
I don't know. I haven't asked her, but it's, I definitely, what I have talked to her about, I mean, we've done a little bit of like comparative Disney. We have definitely talked about the evolution of the bad guy. And how that, and we have also talked about, and this is just, but she still, the fact that she still uses the word bad guy to me is an indicator that she didn't lose that.
Yeah.
And we have talked about the evolution of women, which goes hand in hand with the evolution of, or the evolution of women kind of goes together with me with the evolution, or I was kind of hesitating because it's like when women get powerful, we don't know what to do with men. That's the issue. It's like the women, the virtues of women used to be beauty. That was like pretty much it. It was like, you know, or Cinderella, she also knew how to clean really well. Yeah. You know, and then we get to Jasmine and now we have like curiosity. Now we have a desire for freedom. And then we get to Moana and she's just the heroine. She's just the best. She is the protagonist. Yeah. She's the heroine of the movie. And so we've seen women evolve and she has seen that too. But the thing is that they don't know what to do with the men. What do they do with Maui? Maui gets goofy. And this is, by the way, this is an issue we're all, so I think Disney could help us out a little bit. Because we writ large don't totally know. It's like men don't know totally what to do. When women get more powerful, men get more goofy. No, it's like we need to figure out a new dynamic. And a new
balance.
A new way of relating.
Like the tennis shoe.
What do you mean?
Like the New Balance tennis shoe. It's like called New Balance. Sorry, I get, speaking of goofiness, I get really goofy when it comes to wordplay. It's interesting as you're saying that, I heard a critique of Moana that was basically actually even harsher, which was that, you know, they don't know what to do with the men in Moana, but actually the men's role has been completely displaced in Moana. I wouldn't go that far. I think that the challenge with Disney is that it's not like Disney is this like separate entity that exists apart from human beings, right?
Yeah.
Like we're all trying to figure it out. And I also, the question about the evolution of women is interesting because if you look at Moana, for example, which is one of my favorite films, you know, I teach it in my organization, Theory of Enchantment, and it's really quite powerful. But I was reading this book, Women Who Run with the Wolves. Mm-mm. Do you know this book? It's so good. Highly recommend it. It's basically a book that was written for women, and it's a collection of fairy tales from all over various cultures around the world. And one of the passages that I came across recently, which I really needed to come across, actually, which was don't over-identify with the healer archetype. And it strikes me that Moana is like a healer archetype. And you know it's an archetype and not a real person because Moana doesn't really do anything flawed, right? From the very beginning, she is born a healer. And the ocean recognizes this. Mm-hmm. You know, and gifts her with this capacity to speak to it. But she's like born a healer, basically. And I find myself sometimes over-identifying with the healer archetype, like wanting to fix people. Mm. And there's a passage in Women Who Run with Wolves that says that women tend to fall into this category because they sometimes think that otherwise they're not able to take up space unless they're healing people or healing the situation. And the thing about an archetype is that it's an archetype. It's not a real human being. You can't actually be an archetype, right? An archetype is like a divine ideal symbol. Kind of like I wear this pendant around my neck. It's the Virgin Mary. I wear it because it's a symbol of the divine feminine, right? But it's an archetype. I can't actually, or I shouldn't actually identify with it fully because it's not possible.
It's like an asymptote.
And so even
you can never get there, but that's kind of part of the value of
you can
it.
Never,
as like an aspiration.
Yeah. Oh, 100%, 100%. But what's interesting is like, even as women take on this more powerful role in Disney films, can Disney still portray women as
totally and not just as human beings, but like not lose those virtues? Like beauty is beautiful. Cleaning the house really well, Cinderella, like I don't want to lose that either.
Very important,
you know? So I feel like there's an initial step. It's like, you know, you have black, you have white, then you have gray, and then you end up with like who even knows what. It's like an explosion. But we're kind of in the gray. You said it when you said they've just replaced Moana, just replaced, did you say she replaced the man's role?
She displaced.
It's
the
like
man's
right
role.
Now.
That was a critique I
it's
saw.
Like we're doing a little bit of just like trading places because we don't totally know what to do, but like this is a very co-evolutionary thing. It's like we don't even totally know what it is yet. We kind of have to just like have everyone feeling good and interacting together and relating to each other. And then and then it'll just surprise us. It'll be like, wow, wait, so you're beautiful and you clean the house and you're a leader and you have a loving relationship. This is blowing my mind. You know, like we don't totally know what it's going to be yet, though.
Yeah.
So, and it's like they're even with the more recent women protagonists, it's like I almost feel bad that I'm about to say like Maribel isn't super beautiful and they did that on purpose. You know, it's like we almost have to turn down the volume on some things to kind of like play with like what it's going to be. But to your point, these are people just like us who are writing these stories, and we're all caught in this stuff too.
Right.
So it's like, I mean, do Disney writers have to do some inner work in order to kind of like, absolutely. I mean, we all do.
We all do,
within the context of writing archetypes for us to aspire towards.
Right.
In that context, that would be especially helpful. So Disney writers
and Encanto
all need
is interesting
to do the theory of
in
enchantment
that sense.
Is really, this is basically an
advert. Yes, basically. Yes.
Yeah.
Come back to your higher self and do theory of enchantment. Because, you know, theory of enchantment is very respectful of Disney. I mean, I consider Disney to be sacred. And there are a lot of cynical people who would disagree vehemently with that statement. But I think that the role that Disney plays is so sacred and so beautiful. And so the people working there really need to take stock of their mission and take it seriously. And, you know, if we expand past sort of the Pixar world, because Disney encompasses so much now. If we expand past the Pixar world and we look into Marvel, for example, or actually remind me to say something about Cruella, because I have a lot to say about that film, but I don't know if you've seen that film, but so I'll talk to you about it. Well, I'll talk about Cruella and I'll talk about a particular Disney Marvel villain, again, with the same vein of the roles that women play. So Cruella is sort of the backstory of how Cruella de Vil became Cruella de Vil. And on paper, it's a beautiful film. Like, aesthetically, it's a film about fashion, you know, because she's a fashion designer. There's many different segments in the film where you hear amazing music juxtaposed with her designing like different fashion pieces, basically to upstage her former mentor, who's kind of a terrible person. I mean, she's a terrible person.
And then they're going to do the backstory of that person. That's the next film.
Well, yeah, it just sort
hurt
of like
hurt people
goes back on itself forever. Yeah. And I mean, her former mentor is a terrible person. Her former mentor like killed her mom. Oof. So like an actual terrible person.
But
the problem with
this
film.
Go on. Yeah.
Yes. But the problem with this film, Stephanie, is that nothing Cruella does in her youth or in her whatever young adulthood life is actually cruel.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. It's completely manufactured, right? Like absolutely nothing she does is cruel. And so I'm sitting here watching this film with my roommates. And we're like, oh, this is so cool. It's so powerful. And then by the end, they're still like, it's so cool. It's so powerful. And I'm like, wait a minute. There's nothing cruel about this character. Not whatsoever. Which, again, is a part of the problem with depicting archetypes. Right? There's nothing flawed about this character. Really deeply cruel. I mean, her name is Cruel.
Yeah.
Right? There's nothing cruel about this person. Mm-hmm. And so you see Disney sort of almost shying, at least in this context. Shying away from evil. Whereas in Marvel, I find there sometimes is a greater sense of that complexity. Yeah. So in Marvel,
isn't Marvel more for older? Like maybe it's like a developmental thing. But anyway, go on. Yeah.
Maybe. I thought the demo for Cruella was like older people though. I could be wrong though. That was the vibe that I was getting. But for Marvel, there's Doctor Strange 2 came out recently. Doctor Strange is my favorite Marvel character, but that's irrelevant. The villain in Doctor Strange is a woman. And it's basically WandaVision becomes Scarlet Witch. And so she starts out as a hero and she becomes a villain. And the reason why she becomes a villain is because she learns that in another universe, her children, she has children and they're alive and they're thriving, but she cannot access them in this universe because they're in another universe. So she literally murders like so many people in order to try to get to that alternative reality or universe, whatever you want to call it. And I think that this is so brilliant because it's so real, because it's so rooted in something real and a lived experience, a mother's love for her children, such that she will go to the ends of the earth and destroy anyone who gets in her way. Obviously, there's like, you know, a resolution at the end of the film. But that's real.
Yeah.
That's like real stuff, you know?
Yeah, but then again, it's like what, like the even the source of her evil is in and of itself is a mother's love for her children. So that's, I mean, but that's to your point about the complexity of Marvel. I mean, I mean, Disney, you know, and this is why we're, and I guess, you know, we're not necessarily like picking on Disney. It's like this, like storytellers writ large should, you know, may all storytellers take responsibility for their co-creation of reality. We can just, and Disney as a company recently gotten mired in these, in kind of the, you know, culture war dynamics, that to me, that just me, I totally see what you're saying. And I feel like I understand where they're coming from with wanting to kind of shy away from just straight evil. We're kind of going through this, we're going through this gray. And in a way it's like, maybe in order to, you know, in order to give birth to real gray, we have to just like make everything gray for a second, but then hopefully we come out the other end with black, white and gray and more, you know, but there's definitely kind of a, they're doing a gray thing, but then, but then that gray thing kind of gets them into trouble also as a company. And I mean, we can talk about that in a little bit. I want to kind of stay with the Disney stories for a little longer, but there's a way in which, it's like the stories and them as a company are kind of getting stuck in the same thing.
That's wild. I wonder, you know, I do think that there's a possibility for them to treat gray with the same kind of, like, the Scarlet Witch in Doctor Strange 2 is very evil. Mm. You know, she's obviously mm-hmm. evil. And you understand yeah. where that, what yes. is driving that yes. evil. Yes. Right? And so it's like the exactly. yes and. If Disney could capture yeah. that,
and that's,
I think it would be totally. On better
and
footing.
I mean, I think of that as we don't have to choose between consequences and compassion. We don't have to choose between, like, people yeah. should endure the consequences that are appropriate to their behavior and have the opportunity to grow for their sake and all of ours. Like, we can totally reject yeah. and abhor and what someone did while we understand why and can maybe even relate to
yeah.
why they did it. So yeah, that's the move, is like not turning everything into gray, but like keeping gray and black and white makes for, you know, yeah. the even more complex yeah. and the more accurate storyline. And like the truth is too, like we don't have to let go of just black and white by itself either. Right. That can be its own, like, part mm-hmm. of the archetype, you know? So,
yeah. And I think, yeah, no, you go, oh, you go.
No, no, go ahead. I was just thinking of other ways in which we can kind of see this, like another lens through which to look at this is love, the way love has evolved. So it used to mm-hmm. be very heteronormative, right? It was like the prince and the princess. Yeah. And now we're getting into,
sure.
you know, in Frozen, I mean, they almost do it in this almost like absurdly explicit way where she's, for those of you who haven't watched Frozen, so the only thing that can cure Anna is a kiss from someone who loves her, is like a kiss of true love. And so Anna first like races to yeah. this prince who she thinks loves her, and he, you know, it turns out he doesn't love her and he's not going to kiss her. And then, and then, you know, Olaf, the snowman, tells Anna to go to this other guy who like maybe loves her, you know, but then as she's running to this other guy, she finds that her sister is about to be killed. So she hugs her, she like prevents, she gets in the way of the sword that is about to kill her sister. And, you know, there was no an act of true love is what it was that will save her.
And so
she's looking for a kiss yeah. from this first guy and then the second guy. And then she doesn't make to the second guy on time because she saves her sister, which ends up being the act of true love that saves her and her sister. But it's almost done in this. Yeah. In a way, we may have to be more explicit about things while we give birth to them. It's like, hey, audience, check it out. The love story here is not between a woman and a man. It's between two sisters. And yeah. we just really wanted to let you know
yeah.
that love in Disney is evolving in this way. And then by the time we get to, you know, Encanto, then they don't have to like say it. It's just like the love between the family is the love that we're, but eventually we want all of the above. But I think we're right now we're kind of giving birth to something new, maybe love-wise in Disney.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. It shifts from romantic love to familial love. But what's interesting on that topic is I do wonder, I mean, thinking about Encanto, which was such a different mm-hmm. movie.
Yeah,
for
I
Disney.
Want to spend some time on Encanto. Totally.
And it's fun because it means enchantment. Mm-hmm.
Totally.
So there's so many, you know.
Would that be your teoría de Encanto? Is how you'd say it in Spanish.
Basically.
That's awesome.
Basically. But what's interesting about this is I want to say something about romantic love in general, and the way it has taken shape in Disney, because I think that Disney is still stuck in romantic mm-hmm. love.
Which is why they had to go to family instead of staying with, they're going to come back to romantic love and evolve it, but we're learning how to, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I was telling someone about this the other day. Where does romantic love come from? I learned this from watching this conversation between Marion Woodman and Robert Johnson, who are two Jungian masters, scholars, like, for lack of a better word, well-versed in the Jungian arts from Carl Jung's writings. And basically, romantic love comes from the 12th century, comes from the era of, like, troubadours and knights in shining armor. And it emerged during a time where, basically, religious institutions were collapsing.
And you're, so there was
prior
no,
to okay, this,
yeah, go ahead. I was going to say, so before that, there was no?
Yeah, like, the concept of romantic love is not, like, something that came from the sky.
I've never even asked that question. Wow, that's amazing. God, we give birth to so many amazing things. I gotta hand it to humanity on that
without
one.
Without even realizing it. So it was a product of a cultural time. Religious institutions were dying. And this is really important to understand the context, because what we as a society would do is we would project our image of the divine. If you think about all concepts come from human beings, right? God, the divine, it comes from us, and then we project it out in creative expression, right? So we projected our concept of the divine onto religious institutions. And if you think of a religious institution, because it's not a human being, it's a container that can hold such projections. Right. But as religious institutions started to collapse, we started to project that same idea of divinity onto human beings. And that's where the concept of romantic love comes from. That's where the concept of falling in love comes from, because it's just sort of you're seeing another human being as the absolute perfect being, other half in your mind, which is archetype. Totally nuts. That doesn't make any sense.
Turn them into an archetype.
It's an archetype. Yeah. It's an archetype. Yeah. It's not real. No human being can actually fulfill that.
But by then, you're already married.
So that's why we describe it as falling in love. Right. Well, yeah. So it's Disney. And that, by the way, I think that was a very necessary, developmental stage in our species development. But Disney is still stuck in that concept of love. My friend the other day was watching Happily Ever After, and I caught a glimpse of it. I think it's a retelling of Cinderella's story, basically. And I caught a glimpse of it, and Patrick Dempsey is in it, and I just caught a glimpse of it, and I was like, oh, this is totally absurd. And the problem is that if the cultural cues that we receive are telling us that this is what love is, and what they're actually telling us is that love is something absolutely absurd and managed expectations. This is not what love is. Love is a give and take. Love is actually being in partnership with a person with all their flaws, right? As a human being, not as an archetype. Obviously striving for that ideal, but there's a difference between falling in love with a person in that sort of you're my all divine sense of the phrase.
Totally.
And loving a person, warts and all.
Yeah.
Right? And so, I'll be curious to see if Disney shifts their understanding. Yeah.
I mean, this either brings up your point about the audience has become everybody. And that's tough, because Disney shouldn't necessarily, I don't know, have to do it all, right? We have so many other stories. I mean, we have romantic comedies, we have we have so many other, so does Disney, maybe part of it, the question is, what does Disney want to be? What is Disney's goal? What do they want their function to be in our, as a main organ of our storytelling apparatus? And I don't know. Maybe their role is to show us archetypes, and that's kind of what they want to do. And it's up to the rest of the story, but there is an archetype here that we maybe don't have yet. There is an archetype of real romantic love that is warts and all, and also hard to attain, but an archetype of kind of real love that we would be well served by. Yeah. And that's something that we're still working out ourselves. To the point of there's still people. Yeah.
For sure.
I'm just thinking about my marriage and the marriages I know, and the ones that are more traditional, and I'm thinking, sure, let's just say heteronormative marriages, where they have more traditional roles, to me, that are more peaceful marriages. And peaceful is not what my husband and I are going for, but it's also just a little less peaceful, but we're working something out, we're working something out.
Yeah. I mean, my parents definitely have a more traditional marriage, and I know a lot of families that are religious families that have more traditional marriages, and I would say definitely more peaceful. To your point, there's a time and place and order for everything, and that isn't to say that needs to be, it's maybe the way we do tradition will change.
Yes, exactly. And also peacefulness.
Right? As opposed to dispensing with tradition in its
entirety.
And
part of the reason that and by the way, peacefulness may not also be is not the only goal of a marriage. But the way that, right now we're also kind of working something out, which makes it harder. Whereas, let's say for maybe my kids or something, some things will have been culturally worked out a little bit to the point, or there will be more models to the point where they won't have to be kind of working it out in real time as much.
Yeah. I feel like all of our society is trying to figure out what those models are.
you know,
I was thinking the other day, I was putting manifestations into the, I'm becoming that person. I was putting manifestations into the ether. And I was like, these are all the characteristics that I want my husband to have. But simultaneously, I was just thinking, like, my relationship to marriage is going to be different from what it was for my parents, because I think they took things as given, you know, being bounded by certain traditions, creating their own traditions for sure, creating their new traditions, but still having an incredible respect for tradition mm-hmm. in general. And I do too. Like, I want to raise a family with certain mm-hmm. traditions, but I also want to be very intentional about what mm-hmm. those traditions are. And I think actually it's the work of every generation mm-hmm. to do that. And the problem becomes when we sort of yeah. forget that. And I would ask, especially Disney, which is you know, teeming yeah. with tradition, like, to ask itself, what is its relationship to tradition? What does it want its relationship to tradition to be? It cannot simply move according to the whims of society. Like, it will lose yeah. its way if it does this sort of teeter-tottering, yeah. you know. It has to be very intentional and very conscious. Otherwise, it will lose its identity.
Yeah, I agree. And I also wonder if this is kind of a temporary, just really like letting everything go for a second to just see what new might emerge, and then kind of yeah. just to make room. But what ends up happening, this is how I understand what's happening within the context of gender. It's, we get so scared. Mm. We get so scared of making yeah. room for, you know, that, oh, there's this like, oh my God. And then we're all going to, no one's going to have a gender. We're all going to be gender. It's all going to, you know, that we just don't, it just ends up just, it makes this process of evolution more painful. I could just leave it at that, you know, like, could we just make a little more room for ourselves to grow? We're growing through something. We don't totally understand that yeah. we don't have it worked out. Don't worry, not everybody's going to be whatever. Like, there may be a little more whatever for a small period of time, and that's okay. Like, just yeah. let ourselves grow. Like, yeah. that's kind of like the ultimate, I feel, it maybe like lesson is just learning how to grow with less pain, a little less pain. Because mm-hmm. when there's too much pain, we don't even get yeah. to grow. Then we just fight. Then yeah. we're just stuck and fighting in some ways. Or then... Yeah.
I feel like my Buddhist sensibilities, and that's not to say I am Buddhist, everyone. It's just to say that I have Buddhist sensibilities. I have to make that clarification. Less people just, yeah. Anyway, my Buddhist sensibilities would tell me to ask, what is the role of actually learning how to deal with pain as opposed to getting rid of pain, right? Like, one of the things that James Baldwin said was that people cling to their hatreds and their bigotries because they don't know how to deal with pain. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I've been thinking a lot about how we are a very addict-oriented culture, at mm-hmm. least in America, and how that is driven by our desire to escape pain. Yeah, I'm just sitting with that question, you know, because I think it also has something to do with, if Disney sees itself as merely a form of entertainment and therefore a kind of source of escapism, then how does it deal with pain? I feel like there are layers upon layers upon layers in this unfolding of Disney that we're doing.
Yeah. Well, I love that you identify Disney's role as sacred, and there's some connection to be made here, or somewhere, you know, who historically, hundreds of thousands of, what was the storytelling function? I mean, our original myths were like creation stories, right? It came to us from really, really was a sacred function. So there's something about kind of reconnecting that. And I don't know what that means. You know, what does Disney have? Like a faith leader from every tradition on its staff, maybe, probably, and something.
That would be cool.
That, because, yeah, there's something we really need, and we really kind of need Disney to be for us. Especially right now. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's really well said, and I think that's a great idea, actually.
I like to imagine, I love the council in Black Panther. This is actually how, like every company should have that kind of a council of all of the people who represent the people it most affects. That's the council.
Yeah. Especially, and I don't even mean this negatively, especially given that Disney has appropriated these stories.
True. Totally. Cultures. Good point. Yes.
You know?
And that's such a...
and tribes.
That's such a kind of post... kind of progress. It kind of integrates all the worldviews.
Yeah, it's post-progressive.
Because it's doing the like honoring of the land that we stand on and the things that we appropriated in a way that serve the in like a traditionally kind of a way. It feels like that's a very integral move. That way of doing it.
Yeah. It's like not lip service. You know, it's because I don't believe in this idea. Like there are some people who will say, you know, I'm not going to use the word shaman anymore because it's been culturally appropriated, or like, I don't believe in that. I think that the shaman is John Vervaeke, cognitive scientist from the University of Toronto, said that like the therapist is our modern form of the shaman. Like the therapist is actually serving that same role that the shaman served in ancient times. And the, you know, I believe that the key is not to dispense with these roles, but to actually resurrect them. And like make them mean something in contemporary form, which is that kind of integration, you know, that you're talking about. I think that would be beautiful if Disney did something like that.
Well, Disney, we're available for hire. one other kind of Encanto. So I would love to come back to Encanto. And one thing I'm just going to lay down about Encanto that to me is what. So to me, Encanto is Encanto as a native Spanish speaker. it represents so many kind of like evolutions, let's say, of Disney. One of them is just thematically, Disney stories used to be kind of about the same exact thing every time, right? It was kind of just a love, good versus evil love story where man kind of rescues woman for the most part. And now we're getting into, we're getting into with Moana, Frozen, and just different kinds of stories. And Encanto speaks to maybe what might be my most favorite theme, which is what we've been talking about, this co-creation of reality. So the lyrics of the song, we don't talk about Bruno, this is an amazing song. So I'm just going to go through the lyrics. So she says, it was my wedding day. We were getting ready and there wasn't a cloud in the sky. Bruno walks in with a mischievous grin and it says thunder. And he says, it looks like rain. There's not a cloud in the sky, but Bruno says it looks like rain. In doing so, he floods my brain, married in a hurricane. And now we don't talk about Bruno. It's like Bruno said these words. I thought about them. And then all of a sudden it rained when there was. And now we don't talk about Bruno because we understand that speech is an act of creation. Like we understand the power of speech.
Oh my God, brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant. I wish I would have listened to that song before recording this podcast.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I've had nights where I cannot not listen to it. It's like, it's burned into my brain.
It's like in your head.
Yeah, from my gut. Because we watch it and listen to the soundtrack.
Yeah, the power of speech. So, I mean, it's so fascinating. I have so many thoughts about this because where do I begin? I mean, I don't know. So I think I told you I'm studying the chakra system. So we're going to pause on Disney and fly to the east for a little bit. And
Let's do it.
Talk about the chakra system. So how do I explain the chakra system? The chakra system is a sort of template. And I think it exists in both Hinduism and Buddhism. And it basically argues that it's a metaphor. So don't take it literally, take it symbolically. There are different energy centers in the body that correspond with different parts of the body. And so when we talk about speech, that would be like the throat chakra, right? And like if all the other chakras aren't in balance, then one chakra might be excessive or deficient. And the throat chakra is all about speech, the power of speech, the sacredness of speech. And I was telling my friend the other day, you know, it's so funny that, you know, you watch Harry Potter and they're casting spells at each other in Harry Potter, right? And there's this double meaning to the word spell, because you spell a letter or you spell a word, right? But you also cast spells in Harry Potter. And usually when you cast spells, you have to speak say something. And that's how you cast a spell.
Abracadabra literally it means something like I speak, therefore I create, or something like that in Aramaic.
Yeah. And the thing is, many wisdom traditions have this teaching.
Genesis and God said. Right. And God said,
there be light, and there was light, right? So these are like ancient wisdom traditions that are part of the deep, rich soil of our cultures that are being resurrected, I feel like, slowly but surely, in films like Encanto. And thank goodness they're being resurrected, because, like, I think in many ways, obviously, our culture has lost its way. But, like, that idea that speech, you can co-create reality with speech, is, I think, something that would have, that is still laughed off in certain circles, right? In certain, let's say circles that are very allergic to anything spiritual.
Also in journalism, because they don't want to take, it's like, wait, you mean the way that I cover something affects the thing that I cover? It's like, yep, that is the case. What are you going to do with that? How are you going to steward that power? Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great point and a great question. And I love that Encanto explores this in a very easily digestible way, right? And I do wonder, especially because Disney's, you know, audience is everyone. I always wonder, for the parents who are sitting there with their kids watching this, do they, like, take this seriously?
Or are
they
am.
Like, seeing it as a form of
And to me, it's like, is Disney taking this seriously? It's like, you, like, if speech is an act of creation, like, Disney, what are you gonna speak?
Yeah, speech is an act of creation.
Yeah, because we're all following along here. We're all following along. Like, wouldn't it have been helpful if Maui, you know, his apology was so, like, sorry, not sorry. To me, that's the missed opportunity. Wow. That is, like, a beautiful apology ballad. Like, that's what we need.
At the end. Yeah, the arc.
So, because...
Yeah, the arc of Maui.
That would maybe be the top number one thing I would love to help Disney write, is the lyrics to Maui's apology ballad. But that's, like, it's like Disney, we're all following along here. Or at least, like, I don't know, the kids are, and, like, some of the parents are. hook us up, help us out, give us something to work with. Yeah.
Well, we're co-creating, and maybe the second movie should be called Maui, and we learn more about Maui and his journey and his arc, you know? And, like, the power of speech to co-create reality is so profound. It's something I've been thinking about a lot. And it's really important that Disney heed its own advice. It's not only in the films that it creates, but also in the way it navigates these culture wars.
Totally. That's why, and I wonder how, I mean, I, like, jokingly have said that in response to the Florida situation, they should just have had Elsa give a press conference about the bill. But it's like, I'm kind of not joking, though. It's like, take everything you've learned from all of your films, like, or just give a press conference that everything that is spoken is a lyric from one of their movies. They have what they need.
Yeah.
I mean, they have what they need. It's all there. It's just like, they just get caught up in all the, like, we're anti-pro. It's like, but...
What lyric do you think they would use? Like, do you have one off the top of your head?
What would they be trying to say? They would be trying to say something like, I mean, what's like the integral, I get the question I would ask is, like, what's the integral position?
That is the question.
How can they how can they aim higher than the bill? It should almost be like, forget the bill. We're trying to grow here. We're trying to make room for some things here. And I mean,
that's an interesting challenge.
Like, who's the character? Who's the archetype of...
Who's the archetype? It might be a new archetype.
Yeah, maybe it's a new archetype. Who's the integral archetype?
Like you said.
I don't know. And maybe... Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It's like, it's a joint press conference, Tikka Tafiti. I don't know. The two sides of ourselves coming together to...
That would be so interesting to craft.
That would...
Like, just as an experiment.
So cool. It would also just be so... It's like, already, without even watching it, you kind of have to smile. It's like, I don't even know what they said, but I'm already smiling. That would be very fun to craft.
My wheels are spinning now, but, like, what I would write if I was in, like, the actual speech to the press that I would write if I was in Disney's position, and using what you just said to inform that position. Yeah, it's so interesting. But I will say that, like, and this might be redundant, but, like, I love Disney. I hope it finds its way, even while simultaneously helping us find our way. And we'll do it together, you know, it's a co-creative. Mm-hmm. But it really has to ask itself, this is the price of being a Fortune 500 company, right? Like, if your target market is everyone, then your identity or your product will be diminished. I mean, on some level, unless you risk not having everyone be your, you know, not having everyone be your target market, or you dig so deep, inside yourself that you find that common, the thing that is common to every single human being, and you make that your anchor as an organization. And that's hard because you will lose some, you know, fans, but you also understand that, like, that's cyclical. Like, that's a part of the cycle of life. There's an irony that Disney is portraying more expansive roles for women, while simultaneously as a company, you know, its goal is to grow and to grow and to grow. But I feel like there's sort of like the wisdom of womanhood, which is cyclical.
Yeah.
Right? There's birth and there's death, right? Or there's life and there's death. There's ups and there's downs, right? And so I would be curious, as a company, like, how Disney would, like, view those things.
I mean, well, that's, now you're kind of pointing to the kind of the somewhat of a straitjacket Disney is in as a Fortune 500 public company, you know, which, but that's something it can both, it can also kind of call out. That, I mean, that's that, like, that is something that kind of framing the supervillain as, you know, the rivalrous dynamics we're all stuck in, the multipolar traps and the arms races, and turning that into what Moloch or whatever, that would, that could, that would actually be a helpful use of a bad guy, because then the bad guy is dynamics we're all struggling with that we all want to transcend, that would then enable, I mean, just within the context of Disney, it would, like, alleviate a trade-off between, like, you know, being the stories that, like, we really need versus just, like, having to, you know, profit. It's like the difference between the two different senses of the word growth. It's like optimizing for growth versus financial growth versus optimizing for growing up, or like evolutionary growth. You know, because, and I don't know how much those come into tension with, I don't know how much it's like, well, we actually need to make our quarterly earnings, so therefore we need to do another story that's blah blah blah. But it's affecting it's, I mean, it is. These are constraints that we're all, these are kind of dynamics we're all kind of stuck in. That would be a good use of a bad guy.
And I think that's important that people understand that. Like, I was having a conversation with someone recently and I was sort of thrown off. I love that metaphor, thrown off. This comes from, like, martial arts, you know? I was thrown off because he was in a totally different paradigm. He was in a everything is systems paradigm, excluding the human system, right? Like, everything is like, let's combat the institutions, let's combat the organizations, let's combat the systems, let's reform those systems, but not, let's talk about the human system, right? And it's really important that people understand that precisely what you just said, the dynamics that are afoot in Disney are also dynamics that are afoot within every single one of us, which is precisely why they're operating on that level of a company. Right. So we have to, it would be incumbent upon us, if we want to change that, to sort of, like, examine how they arise in our own life. And if my tendency, let's just use my dating life, because why not? If my tendency is to, it's like when I'm really into a guy and I feel, like, very clingy or very possessive, right? Then in that moment, I'm actually like caught up in the power principle, right? I'm not allowing that person to be who they are and, like, love them as they are. I want that person to become an archetype, right? And, like, be totally removed of all flaws. And so in that moment, I'm experiencing a characteristic that is very much possessive and therefore power hungry. And so if you scale that up, you get, like, you know, nuclear arms race, right? It starts with the human being. It's not like you skip the human being and then you just go to the nuclear arms race. So
I remember I heard something the other day of, like, all the problems in the world come down to people not wanting to feel uncomfortable emotions. Like, there's a lot of truth there.
I mean, I think that goes back to what we were talking about when we talk about pain. Yeah. I like being able to deal with pain, you know, and not trying to escape it. I'm trying to like, but like, can you sit with pain? Can you sit with the sensations in the body and help and allow it to teach you something?
And we can differentiate between different kinds of pain. We could say there's destructive pain and evolutionary pain, but you can tell the difference between the pain of like a really good massage versus the pain where you're like willing or labor, which is like, I mean, it does get excruciating, but like up until a point I am breathing through it. I am like willingly and like, you know, like collaborating with it in order to make something happen, in order to get my cervix to open up. Like there's a, I'm collaborating with you to get something done here to open. Yeah. So like be discerning, let's say, about the pain, but like, and when the pain, if it's a pain that can enable growth or regeneration or then there's like, gotta learn to be with it, brave with it. Yeah.
Yeah. That differentiation is key. But I fear that the more we go into escapism or addiction, the less that muscle or that instrument is attuned to be able to differentiate in the first place. I mean, I find that to be the case for myself. Yeah. You know, if I'm taking weed to like escape as opposed to really like, I don't know, experience some musical artistic thing, is going to be very much diminished because I escaped it instead of just like allowing myself to sit with it. So all the work that Disney must do, we must also do as human beings.
Amen. Amen. Well, where can Disney find you? Where can Disney and everybody else, as we all work through these things, where can we find you, Chloe?
Ethereumenchantment.com. Disney and everyone else can find me at Theory of Enchantment. I'm also active on social media occasionally. I have a podcast called The Heart Speaks, and you can find clips of that on Instagram and YouTube. This will probably be posted on YouTube as well. So look for it there. You can follow me on Twitter, all the social media platforms that you probably know of, except for like TikTok. I am available on.
Awesome.
What about you, Stephanie?
You can find me on Twitter at Steph Lepp. I think you and I, I'm going to just toot our horns for a second. You and I are two of the only people I see who are, taking responsibility for our co-creation of reality on Twitter. I appreciate, I feel like, I'm tooting our horns. We're kind of, our feeds are a breath of fresh air. I've found a few others, but, I think we are both, I mean, I am committed, and it feels like you are committed too, to being thoughtful. Yeah.
Yeah. Abracadabra is no joke. Totally. You guys. But like, that's some serious stuff.
Cool.
Well, awesome.